Book 5, Chapter 4, Crumbs from the Master's Table. It may have been news of the attempt to make Jesus king, carried by Passover pilgrims to Jerusalem, which was responsible for a further deputation of scribes and Pharisees to Galilee. It is obvious that they had come with the intention of joining issue with Jesus immediately. The feeding of the multitudes had given them the clue to their approach. It would have been impossible for all the people to have observed the important rite of washing the hands before eating. The scribes had little difficulty in discovering the disciples at fault in this. They approached Jesus. "Why walk not thy disciples according to the traditions of the elders, but eat bread with unwashed hands?" They could not have been prepared for the withering attack that met them. The battle was joined. No quarter would be asked or given until the end. Jesus, neither justifying nor apologizing for his disciples, exposed the fatal gulf between the law of God and their tradition. We can hardly appreciate the full significance of the crude blasphemy which the rabbinic writings contained, and which were included in a tradition made more binding than Scripture itself. For the first time he flung at them the charge of hypocrisy. "Well hath Isaiah prophesied of you hypocrites, as it is written, the people honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Howbeit in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrine the commandments of men." They must have been startled by this sudden attack, with its accusation made more devastating by his holy wrath. But he had not finished with them yet. The crowd stood a little way off, watching in amazement this wandering rabbi from Nazareth who had become a symbol of fiery judgment. He returned to the attack, dealing a death blow to their traditions, exposing them as self-condemned to all who had ears to hear. Not only did they set aside the law of God, they positively rejected it in order to replace it with commandments ingeniously compiled to serve their selfish ends. He quoted the case of Corban, by which a man might be released from God's command to honor his father and mother by dedicating his wealth to the altar. But the sin was more terrible than that. It freed them by deceit from obedience to God. His gift was a pretense. He was under no obligation, in spite of his promised Corban, to lose his money. "And," said Jesus, "many such like things do ye." Turning to the wondering multitude, he commanded them to come near and hear his answer to their charge. He spoke with great earnestness, compelling their attention. "Hearken unto me, every one of you, and understand," he said. And a moment later, "If any man have ears to hear, let him hear." He was about to tell them something of the greatest importance, which showed the striking contrast between his teaching and that of the scribes. They had found fault because the disciples had eaten with unwashed hands, thereby defiling the food they ate. That, he maintained, was impossible. Defilement does not go into a man from without, it comes out from within. Here lay the essential difference between the commandments of men and the law of God. The scribes supported the teaching that said that because the hands were not washed, the bread was polluted, and the eater defiled. Jesus said it was what was in the heart of man which issued out of him in evil thoughts, murders, pride, and wickedness which defiled him. He showed that the scribes were fundamentally wrong, because by a tradition of externalism they sought by outward observance to influence the inner man. That could never be. The law of God, presented by Christ, addressed itself to the inward man, transforming the heart, and therefore the qualities which issued from the heart, the character and conduct. The whole teaching of Christ, crystallized in the Sermon on the Mount, was dedicated to this task. The disciples, on reaching the house, asked him for a clear understanding of this. He gave them the appalling catalogue of depravity hidden in the natural heart. He was also giving them hour by hour and day by day the perfect example of the qualities which shone forth from a heart which was entirely dedicated to God. The scribes do not appear to have had any desire to renew their attack, nor were they now to have a further opportunity. It was still the obvious desire of Jesus to move away from the crowds and find a secluded place where, free from interruption, he could continue to instruct his disciples and unfold to them a picture of the days that lay ahead. They must not be irretrievably lost when they see the nature of the crown that is destined for his head. They must remember these words in the Galilean hills, The desert on the eastern shore of the lake had proved to be too near the center of his popularity. This time, he decided to withdraw far beyond the range of the importunate crowds. He traveled northwestwards for about 30 miles into the mountains of Upper Galilee, reaching at last the borders of Tyre and Sidon. There is no reason to believe that Jesus went over these borders into the land of the Gentiles. The evidence suggests that he did not. He entered into a house on the Galilean side of the boundary and, in Mark's words, would have no man know it. But he could not be hid. A Syrophoenician woman was in deepest distress because her daughter had an unclean spirit. She had heard of the fame of Jesus and, crossing the border, sought for him. After anxious inquiry, she found him. How her heart would leap with joy when she saw him! She threw herself at his feet. "Have mercy on me, O Lord, thou son of David! My daughter is grievously vexed with a devil." She had found him. Her faith would suffice. She lay there at his feet. Her ears waited for the word which would turn the anguish in her soul into joy. There was no response from the quiet figure, no gracious hand to lift her up. No power flowed forth to meet her cry of faith. No word of comfort broke the stillness. In silence, he watched her piteous appeal for help. Quietly, he left her with her burden and her grief. Still, she clung to her belief in him. She followed, crying, imploring, beseeching, until her persistence disclosed a hardness in the hearts of disciples which must yet be softened. "Send her away," they besought the Lord, "for she crieth after us." Where lies the secret of his silence? Why were the fountains of his mercy sealed? Surely the answer lies in the manner of the woman's approach. Jesus was too great to be patronized. In her need, she addressed him as, "Thou son of David." What could she know of the meaning of this title she had so glibly used? David had not been king of Syria. His greater son had not crossed the borders of Galilee. Like the woman who had touched the hem of his garment, she too has something to learn. Spiritual discernment of her relationship with Israel must take the blindness from her faith. Jesus makes answer to the disciples, not to her. "I am not sent, but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Quickly she discerns her mistake. Worshipping him, she implores once more, appealing to him no longer as the son of David, who belonged only to Israel, but as the Lord, the universal helper of all mankind. She accepts his rebuke, but she will not leave him. Her need is desperate. "Lord, help me." At last he speaks. His words press the teaching home. She will never forget now that salvation is of the Jews. It is a hard saying, but he has spoken, and in his words there is a gleam of hope. It is not meet to take the children's bread and cast it to dogs. With that sudden inspiration which so often comes in the presence of Christ, she accepts his answer. There is yet hope. There are crumbs. "True, Lord, yet the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Surely it was given her in that moment what to speak. How could she have known that the children had so recently refused the bread? How had she learned that they had driven him at that moment to the very border of the table? And was not he the master of the dogs also? Was not she here in faith at his feet? How beautifully Jesus responded to this woman who had wrestled with the sun and had prevailed. Her sorrow had endured for a night, but joy had come in the morning. "O woman, great is thy faith. Be it unto thee even as thou wilt." Enlightened faith had at last called forth the responsive power of Jesus, and away, over the border in a heathen land, a little girl stirred upon her bed and then lay back with a smile of peace.